This episode is brought to you by Diageo Bar Academy. Learn more at DiageoBarAcademy.com. Well, hello, welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer, and it is Wednesday, September 22nd, 2021. This is our 301st episode of this series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talent in the hospitality industry. Today, I have two guests, an impressive husband and wife chef team of a multifaceted food company based in West Philadelphia, and I will introduce them fully in a moment. First, as I do in every show, I will start out with my PR tip. Then later, we will have my speed round game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, and the final question. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip the show off with my PR tip of the week. So today's tip is to be the change you want to see in the world. Let's aim to make a difference, not only by expressing our opinions vocally, but acting upon what we believe in. We can all influence, inspire, and make an impact with hard work, determination, and passion, and by practicing what we preach. So let's remember to walk the walk and not just talk the talk, as actions speak louder than words. That's my tip today. All right, I'm very excited to have my two guests joining me. First, Omar Tate, a chef, artist, and co-founder of Honeysuckle Projects, a multifaceted food company that focuses on the nuanced cultures and cuisines of the Black diaspora. Omar has emerged as a visionary and leading thinker on the restaurant industry's cultural development as a whole. In 2020, Honeysuckle was named Pop-Up of the Year by Esquire magazine, and in 2021, Time magazine named Omar as one of the 100 innovators to watch as part of their Time 100 Next list. My second guest is Sybil St. Aude Tate, a Haitian-American chef and children's book author who is a partner in Honeysuckle Projects with her husband, Omar. Between her 16-year career in the restaurant industry and degree in African-American studies specializing in Caribbean culture and aesthetics in America, Sybil has found a niche in cultivating a relative Caribbean food experience that expands the narrative of her identity. Without further ado, hi, Omar and Sybil. Welcome to the show.
Hey.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you. We're glad to be on.
Yes, very excited to have you both on, both in separate locations now, although we'll get into how closely you work together on a day-to-day basis. But let's start out a bit with your backgrounds. How did you both get started in the hospitality industry, and like what drew you in? Omar, do you want to go first?
This is a funny question because people ask me this a lot. The actual answer is nothing drew me in. I did not want to be a cook. I did not desire to work in restaurants. I actually just needed a job. And I've been in hospitality since the age of 17. Beginning as a dishwasher and an overnight porter at the Philadelphia Marriott downtown that's connected to the convention center. And I worked there for about 2.5 to 3 years in that entire time. The dish room is actually like really huge. It's the size of a $1,400 studio apartment in Brooklyn and adjacent to the kitchen. And I never had any interest in what the chefs were doing. And it wasn't really until after my son was born that I took an interest in cooking when, again, I just needed a job, but I felt like I needed a job that I could define myself around. So I lied on a resume and said that I actually cooked because of my proximity to kitchens and hotel work. And when I was hired, the chefs immediately understood that I didn't know what the hell I was doing or what I was talking about. The first request was to brunoise shallot, and I didn't know what either one of those words meant. But they appreciated my zeal because it was very far from where I lived. It was 30 miles outside of Philadelphia, and I was traveling by public transportation 2.5 hours a day to get there. So they decided to train me, and I worked at this golf club for 1.5 years, and that was my start.
Wow. Okay. Good. No, it's good to know. And what about you, Sybil?
Yeah. So I didn't, I wasn't as less inclined to kind of fall into the restaurant industry as Omar. My mom actually, so my family's from Haiti, and my mom was trained as a chef in Haiti. But when she migrated over to the States, she became a nurse. And in the household, she still kind of upheld those techniques and those words and keywords and phrases and teachings to me around food and just really French cuisine. But I didn't care too much because I was a kid, but as a teenager, I needed a job, and the restaurant industry was perfect, a perfect way to make some fast cash as a kid on Long Island trying to like put gas in your car. So I started front of the house and went to college. And when I graduated, I came back home and I needed to pay off some student loans to get to grad school. And I ended up just falling into it. I had a chef friend, mentor, who kind of just pulled me into the back of the house and started me from the very bottom. And I fell in love with it. So it wasn't something I was really looking for, although I was very familiar with food and techniques and all those fun things. But it just kind of just happened out of a necessity to do something different, to pay Sally Mae, really.
Right. So when did you two meet, and when was Honeysuckle formed? Because I'm not sure which came first.
Well, Honeysuckle came first as a pop-up concept that I started in 2017 as a way for me to explore my own personal narratives and where that fits into the larger story of Black Americans as a whole. And that lasted right up until the pandemic. And Sybil loves to tell this story, so I'll let her tell the story.
So Omar had been doing Honeysuckle pop-ups. I had been doing my own Haitian American experience pop-ups in New York under a company called Earthseed Provisions. And we were both asked to do a dinner together at the Charleston Wine and Food Festival by our great friend, BJ Dennis. He put us on a dinner, and we had known of each other, but we had never really met before. And so we worked this dinner together and fell in love.
I love it.
Yeah. So it was kind of just, it was really immediate. It was like a wonderful romantic comedy weekend in Charleston, surrounded by food, friends, and culture. And then the pandemic hit. And we were both kind of, you know, readjusting our respective business models and, you know, the idea to kind of collaborate and to join forces and to really work on something together arose. And Omar had moved back to Philly, and I was interested in moving to Philly as well. And it was just kind of one of those things that just made sense. And so it was, it was born. Honeysuckle Provisions was born.
And then in the midst of all that, we got married.
All right. Yeah, we got married.
Well, I was at the Charleston Wine and Food Festival this last, right before the pandemic. I didn't fall in love there. I love Charleston, but maybe my next one.
I mean, yeah. So we're doing a dinner. I don't think it's been announced yet, but we're doing another dinner there. And so if you come and visit and attend our dinner, maybe someone at your table might be, you know.
Maybe. I'm putting it out into the universe. So. Oh, wow. That's really cool and special. So, okay. So you came back and yeah, so you're in the, I mean, talk a bit about getting through. I mean, we're still not completely out of it, but in the pandemic, like how did you guys cope, deal, the big word of the year was pivot and being in Philadelphia, like what was it like?
Well, I mean, me personally coping, I did a lot of writing, when the pandemic began, and this kind of answers the question about the pivot as well. The pop-ups were going on, they completely shut down come March 17th, 2020, everyone canceled everything. Obviously we all know about that. And I was really, you know, looking at myself in the mirror, questioning, you know, asking myself just a lot of questions. And that's what really made me understand that Honeysuckle wasn't just about food. I mean, I always knew that, but it truly is a philosophy and the approach to how Now we look at our method of thinking around Black and Afrocentric culture. And so through that, I personally was able to write and create poetry and sell zines. And to also add to that, I did some delivery with Caviar and did some pop-ups. Not Caviar the food, Caviar the...
right. Yeah. I knew that. I mean, yeah, our audience probably knew that.
And then continue Honeysuckle as a takeout pop-up out of the kitchen of our good friends at South Philly Barbacoa. That was how it continued as just Honeysuckle pop-up. But as Sybil and I continued to talk and people began to kind of lighten up a little bit and at least come out to come pick up food, we did a couple of pop-ups under her brand, then Kiona and Earthsea Provisions over the summer. And then did another Honeysuckle pop-up together in September under that we created called Black Labor Day in September. And so, I mean, I think, you know, speaking for myself here, coping was more or less just living through our culture and philosophies and continuing to live through food, because that's pretty much all we had, you know, and one another.
Yeah, I'm going to agree completely. You know, Omar kind of fell into writing. I fell into a lot of reading and listening to music. Big music head. Actually, both of us are. And music plays so much into our food and our dining experiences. It was kind of a moment for the virtual DJs and just for being home and listening to music and kind of being with yourself. And so we were able to do that. And that was a big way to cope, for sure. For sure.
Yeah. And then how did your chef in residence at Stone Barns come about, which I was so glad I got to attend. It was so special and meet both of you there. But did, what was, would Dan Barber just give you a ring?
honestly, that's exactly what happened.
I thought so.
Yeah. So Sybil and I were just minding our own business one day. you know, it's interesting. I was very surprised at first. So last July in the summer, we launched a fundraising campaign for Honeysuckle, which is now going to be Honeysuckle Provisions as a community center. Still formulating the idea, but we knew that we needed to raise $250,000 to acquire property as like a down payment on a building to get things started. And that's kind of like really where our minds were and focusing on those things. And then in October, Dan Barber called me and asked if I would like to be a part of the Chefs in Residence program. I have no idea how he got my name or even found me. I just, before he called me, he started following me on Instagram one day and I was like, hey, this is Dan Barber. I'm like, oh, wow. So then when he called and he asked me to do it, my first response was trepidation. You know, I don't know. Last year was a year, you know, with Black Lives Matter and all sorts of insecurities around reasons why things happen, you know? And Sybil and I had our internal conversations about that, but we had three or four more conversations with Chef Dan, and we understood that the culture shifts that they were trying to put forth there in Stone Barns and at Blue Hill was thorough and unique and genuine. So after those three or four conversations, we went for a visit in December, had our very first dinner at Blue Hill in our lives, which was delicious.
Very delicious.
And then the residency began in March, February. Mm-hmm.
For those who couldn't attend, how would you, I mean, you want to tell us a little about like how you designed the menu and the storytelling behind it? Because it wasn't, I mean, it was one thing, the food on the plate and the eating and deliciousness, but it was a whole experience from when you entered to when you left.
Yeah, so when Chef Dan asked to do the residency, what he asked me to do was to, you know, what was my interpretation of the landscape at Stone Barns? And the food that Honeysuckle was doing as a pop-up before really didn't just look at, farm to table or soil to plate or anything that linear. I really tried to pull together many, many different references and mental resources through literature, through art, through history, through contemporary ideas around what a Black experience looked like. And given the circumstances of last year, our current moment was really weighing heavily on my mind. And it wasn't until after writing one menu that was terrible and going through several different things and conversations internally that the menu itself emerged as really representative of Black life. And it was Sybil who looked at the menu and she pointed out that it was really traveling through time, I don't know if you want to touch on that, Sybil.
Well, yeah, I think just from the courses and the inspirations and references that Omar had used for each course, it was literally like traveling through time. And I mean, you started off in the streets of Philadelphia with the plateware, which Omar could talk about the collaboration with Greg Moore a little bit, because that was also very special. And just as you eat and as you carry on through the dish, it's just, there are various elements and key figures that inspired and shaped the framing behind it. And I mean, it didn't really, I mean, I saw it on the menu looking at it and I was like, oh yeah, this is definitely like traveling through time. But it also felt like I was traveling through life cycles of just being Black in America, where you started out with like a very heavy, dreadful feeling and thinking about just like the death of young Black boys in our inner cities. And then you get towards the end to the Edna Lewis cake and to the honeysuckle ice cream. It was just like a joyous kind of celebration. And so it's like the highs and lows of like Black life in America at such a poignant time when we were literally kind of going through those shifts ourselves and as a community. So it was just such a special menu and a special moment in time. And if you were there, you really understood, just you got what Omar was trying to give in that moment. And it's just something that I don't think anyone's going to ever experience ever again.
Yeah, I mean, I really think that people don't really know, if you didn't dine, that there was an art gallery that you entered before you even had dinner. And I made a lot of that art myself, and then collaborated with artist and professor Craig Moore, who also has been collaborating with Chef Dan for making ceramics for dishes that happened at Blue Hill for years. But that art gallery really puts you into the place and context of the meal you were about to have. Some of the pieces, one was called Wallace Thurman in a Black Square, which is a nod to a writer named Wallace Thurman who was a writer during the Harlem Renaissance, and people just don't really know who he is. But he was an editor for lots of folks like Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston, Richard Wright, and died at the age of 27. And it really, the painting itself is a poem that I wrote that's layered in all Black several different times. It took a month to make this painting, where when you get close to it, you can't beat it until you get close to it. And it's about being seen. And so much about that meal was really about being seen, but also about what occurs when one is seen, whether it's violence, whether it's joy, whether it's pain, and that all kind of depends on who is seeing you. So I think that when people left, they felt, at least for a moment, a deep empathy around the experience that Black folks have on a daily basis.
Yeah, I think it's also important to note the energy that we brought into this space with the centerpiece, and what we called the altar. We had images of our ancestors hanging around. We had wonderful provisions and rice and all these wonderful, delicious things kind of in the centerpiece, inviting those energies, inviting the spirits of those who've kind of just like guided us throughout our lives and will continue to into that space. And so it was... It was something else. I mean, I can't.
Yeah. It really was. And I talked about it on episode 282 as my solo dining experience. People want to hear my take on it. And I don't know if I did it justice, but it was really special. And going solo, and I've said this in the past, or I've written about it, but like, it's something when you're dining alone, you really can focus on everything around you because there's no distractions and what's happening in your plate and the ambiance. So I think it was a perfect solo dining experience, and you know that I could really take it all in. Mm-hmm. And I was glad to meet you guys and get back up to Stone Barns. I'd been there once before with a large group many, many years ago. So it's such an awesome property.
Yeah. It's like Disney World for like those in the industry.
Yeah, I could see that. So let's talk a little about what's happening now with your GoFundMe and with your projects between Honeysuckle Projects and Honeysuckle Provisions. Maybe Sybil, you want to?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So the GoFundMe, we are doing well, but we do have a ways to go. We have acquired a farm in July. We acquired a farm over in West Philadelphia on a market where we were able to grow some really, really fun peas and greens and just really get to understand the soil. Where we are, it's about a quarter of an acre, and we hope to really develop this land and really jumpstart an agricultural aspect of Honeysuckle that will help like fuel the cafe and the grocery store and the supper club. So we are hopefully moving forward with our cafe space in November. Well, we will be able to jumpstart our grocery kit program, where we're going to pretty much package together items that you can find in the full-fledged grocery store. A little bit of pantry items, a little bit of produce, a little bit of a protein at a reasonable price that feeds a family of four, really trying to kind of make sustainable, fresh, good food available to the community members in this West Philadelphia area. So hopefully we can open up that cafe and concept spot, which is on 48th and Spruce in November. And then the larger image or vision of the grocery supper club, cafe library, like the super center, I like to call it Honeysuckle Super Center, we'll be able to open up in maybe like quarter three or four of 2022. So there's still a ways to go, but we are doing very well, and we're just really excited to kind of get back to cooking. You know, it was a little bit of a lull. As new business owners, there are some things that we learned along the way that we weren't privy to, that we didn't quite understand as some young
things that we learned along the way.
So many things. And, you know, it was a little bumpy for a while there, but we kept our heads down and kept working. And we are just really excited to continue to serve this West Philadelphia community and to really expand on all the things we want to do and, you know, maybe not stop at West Philadelphia and take Honeysuckle all over the place.
Oh, that would be exciting. I am not surprised you even are thinking that way. So let me ask you both my question for my last guest on episode 300. I had on Danielle Balloud, chef and restaurateur of over 15 restaurants worldwide, including his flagship 2 Michelin star Danielle in New York City. We all know Danielle. We love him. He wants to know, will you join us with mentor? He says mentor or mentor. You know, beautiful French accent, which is the foundation that he created with Thomas Keller and Jerome Bocuse. And they started it, they started in the beginning to support the U.S. team at Bocuse d'Or competition, but since it's grown, the organization has grown to support the future of mentorship. So which he believes is very important. So his question was, would you like to get involved with Mentor?
Wow.
Right. But it's a good spot to be in, I would say.
I don't think there's a... You know, there's a response in kitchens. Yes, chef, right?
Yep, that's it.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or actually, well, it's we chef.
We chef. Yes, we chef. Mm-hmm.
Do you, I mean, with mentorship, is that something you're involved in now? Or is it something, and what's your team like these days? Are you guys just doing everything yourself.
Well, there's no way we could do everything ourselves anymore. Actually, we shouldn't have been doing everything ourselves in the past.
Yeah.
I think absolutely the answer is mentorship is key to our relationship with our employees. So currently we have 4 employees. They're all young cooks. 2 of them have actually left jobs in the middle of a pandemic to come work for us because they find what we're doing reflective and very, very interesting and very, very thoughtful. And within that, you know, we build an atmosphere and an environment of holistic care where we're interested in their ideas and not just their labor. We're interested in their growth and not just where they are at the moment, you know. And I think that that is really where young cooks would like to be, especially given the last couple of years of kind of talking about upending the pre-existing system that many people relate to brigade kitchens and you know, just we call old school kitchens. I think people are just looking for something fresh and new to dig their heels and their teeth and their hands into. And obviously we've talked a lot about the experiences that we create, and those experiences are 360 experiences where we're talking about history openly and actively. We're talking about nostalgia and emotion openly and actively, and trying to lay those personal markers like hands down on our food at every single touch point, whether it's the plate, the actual food, the decor, the language. So I think that we're kind of forced to mentor because that's just not something that I've ever seen or have ever had the opportunity to take part in any job, in any career path.
Yeah, I agree. I think for folks in marginalized communities that enter these kind of these major industries, we kind of get lost in the sauce, for lack of a better phrase. And mentorship is easier to come by if you have someone that kind of can relate, has similar life experiences, or sometimes even just looks like you, is around to help you along that path. And with the exception of that first chef that I came across in my early teens, I haven't seen that so much in other restaurants that I've worked in. And so it's super important and vital that we create that culture at Honeysuckle where we are mentoring, and also that we just care for humans in general that kind of come through our doors, whether it be our team members or our customers. And if that means mentoring someone that works with us or someone that is just a customer, you know, that's something that we really take seriously and want to continue to grow and develop, because we didn't have that ourselves.
Yeah, amazing. I'm so glad he asked that question, and it was so great answers. So perfect. Okay, let's take a little break here on that note. We will come back. We'll play my speed round. We'll talk some industry news. I have my solo dining experience and the final question. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. Diageo Bar Academy is a free online resource for hospitality professionals, offering resources for bartenders at all levels. Whether you are a bartender, barback, or manager, or completely new to the industry, Diageo Bar Academy has easy-to-access, free resources to help you learn new skills, providing everything you need to raise the bar and enhance your career. From members-only content like e-learnings and downloadable tools, to masterclass events with global industry experts. And if you didn't already know, Diageo Bar Academy is the marquee sponsor of the Tales of the Cocktail Foundation's 2021 Spirited Awards directory, and will be hosting a watch party on September 23rd. This year's Spirited Awards theme is community, acknowledging the hard work and resilience of the hospitality industry over the last year. Watch live at DiageoBarAcademy.com and root on my colleagues. The Speakeasy, Back Bar, and Agave Road Trip are all up for the Best Podcast Award, which is really cool. So wishing them the best, And again, cheer them on and watch at DiageoBarAcademy.com. Also visit DiageoBarAcademy.com to learn more and gain access to educational initiatives, digital seminars, Beyond the Bar activations, as well as some in-person events in cities around the world. That's DiageoBarAcademy.com. Become a member and sign up for the newsletter today. It's completely free and you will be amazed at all they have to offer. So why wait? Again, that's DiageoBarAcademy.com, DiageoBarAcademy.com. Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guests today are chef founder Omar Tate and his wife, business partner, Chef Sybil St. Aude Tate of Honeysuckle Projects, a multifaceted food company that focuses on the nuanced cultures and cuisines of the Black diaspora. Okay, Omar and Sybil, it's time for my speed round. So what this is I'm going to name a couple things and you get to pick your preference, such as chocolate or vanilla.
Ooh.
You guys ready?
Yeah.
I'm ready. Here we go. Eat in at home or eat out at a restaurant?
Eat in.
That was great. Are you sure you're a couple? No. How about indoor dining or al fresco dining?
Al fresco.
Al fresco.
Wine, beer, cocktail, mocktail, or champagne?
Champagne.
Did you say champagne too?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
We have 2 bottles of champagne in the fridge right now.
Yeah.
Ready to go, right? Ready to pop. Okay, tasting menu or a la carte?
Tasting menu.
Tasting menu. Yeah.
Yeah.
Small plates or large plates?
Small plates.
I think actually large plates, because you can share them with more
people. How about communal table or chef's counter?
Chef's counter. Always. Yeah.
What did you say, Omar? Do chef's counter.
Chef's counter all day. Yeah.
Okay. All right. That's my choice. Cooking for one another or cooking for guests?
Ooh, I'm going one another.
Yeah, the romantic in me says one another, but
yep. Smart.
This is supposed to be a lightning round, but it's hard because I think we both love both of them the same, but mm-hmm. for different reasons.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I do enjoy cooking for others, but I don't know. I guess it's something about being married that you know what the other person likes very well. And there's a joy that comes with being able to like hit all those markers, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, that's nice. Mm-hmm. Okay, 3 more. Pats or Geno's?
Or.
Neither. Neither one. And if you're listening to this, I'm not even like.
I know I've had this one for other guests from Philly, and they usually give me, I don't know, like another choice, even though I don't know. What's yours on the Sybil?
I mean, same. Neither. As a native New Yorker, when I traveled to Philly, like I didn't know any better, and I would hit up, you know, Pat's or Geno's, and I'd be like, oh, this is a cheesesteak. And then I met Omar, and he was like, no. So I've been converted, so neither.
All right, cool. I tried them once, and I'm not, yeah, I'm, yeah, I mean, it's like, it's one of those, it's just one of those things still associated with Philadelphia, and though they're so, I mean, Philadelphia is amazing food. Mm-hmm. Okay. Cheese plate or dessert?
Dessert.
No doubt on that one. And my last one is Manhattan, Brooklyn, or Philadelphia?
Philadelphia.
Yeah. Yeah. That gets the same Pat's or Geno's response from me.
Awesome. Well, that was fun. I like it with fun, especially fun as a couple playing together. Okay, so for industry news, I picked out an article that was in the New York Times. It's entitled, How to Make the Unloved Job More Attractive. Or actually, there's a question mark on that. How to make the unloved job more attractive? Restaurants tinker with wages. As they struggle to recruit workers, many workers are raising pay. But some are trying to go deeper to make their business fairer and more humane. And this was by Jane Black. And this is something I've talked about in a lot of the industry news segments on my show recently, just about the struggle of restaurants to find workers and how restaurants are dealing. And this article is a little on the, you know, the solution or what restaurants are trying to do with paying more and raising wages. You guys, I figured it would be great to talk with you about it as chefs and restaurateurs. Were you able to see this piece, and do you have any feeling about what's happening?
I mean, I think we kind of touched on it earlier.
Yeah.
When we were describing our engagement with our own employees. But to answer that question a little more targetedly, I think that I don't think that it's fair to ask the parts within the system, like how to fix this problem. You know, I think it's a systemic problem. The way that our industries, regardless of what the business is, it's about productivity, right? And the motivator of money is no longer looking like it's the solution to continue folks to want to put their bodies out there to produce. And if it's not serving more than just their pockets or wallets, especially after the pandemic, especially during a pandemic where so many lives have been lost, and reflecting and being able to reflect on that at every turn, every time you look at someone in a mask, you're reminded that our time here is not long, you know? Mm. And so I think that what we really need to do is look at our systems from a policy level, how to support small business owners more robustly than we are, so that we can be more enticing and more appealing to workers, to laborers. We're putting ourselves out on a limb here. Every single week, we're looking at our balance book. Like, are we going to be able to pay our workers the living wage that we're paying them right now? Because this business is just so fragile. And we're figuring out ways to do it through grants and things like that. But, you know, if not for that, I'm not sure if we'd be making it.
Yeah, it's we definitely pay a very, very competitive living wage for our employees just because we've been there and we've known what it is to struggle to make ends meet working a job that you're just given your whole entire life and your being to. And we don't want that kind of establishment. We don't want that kind of culture. And so aside from paying workers more, I think it's just improving on quality of life makes a big difference in why people want to stay employed and why people come back and why the retention rates are the way they are. It's instead of looking at people like machines, you know, consider their humanity and consider the energy and the effort that they're putting into this work, especially food work, food business, because it's just so much of yourself is being poured into a dish to make your customers happy. I think that we cannot let workers kind of fall by the wayside and not consider how they themselves are being taken care of.
Yeah, well said. I mean, I thought it was a good read. There was of what restaurants it was a mix. It was some New York. It was actually Philly. They had Ellen Yin was quoted in it, who's a guest on my show from High Street Hospitality Group. And she was talking this beyond wages. She's offered a health plan for a while, but she's adding lower premiums and a student debt reduction program. There was someone talking about making it a 4-day work week if possible for employees. Amanda Cohn is quoted in this article. She switched to the no tipping model a while ago. She's really a pioneer of that and she's stuck with it. And they were saying she's paying her employees $25 an hour. And she streamlined her menu and she said she's making a little profit now. I mean, I think she said 5%. It's like the margins are so tight.
Yeah.
it's like crazy, but it's, you know, it's interesting to see what restaurateurs are trying to do to attract people and maintain them. And it's tricky though. I know.
Yeah. It isn't easy. And we're so grateful to have a person like Ellen Yin, in our circle who can kind of help, mentor us in things like this, you know,
one of our biggest supporters and
yeah,
we have these conversations with, you know, friends in the business, locally and in New York all the time, mm-hmm. Around, you know, how to be dexterous in this industry. Mm-hmm. But I just, you know, I can't stress enough how precarious it is. And if there is not more support, coming from, state and federal government, I'm not sure what it will look like in the next.
Yeah, but an emphasis on supporting like the little guys in the industry. You know, it's great that the more popular restaurants and the exclusive fine dining establishments get all the support they need. But, you know, the mom and pops, the local places, the takeouts, they need support as well. And I think that shift needs to be a little more intentional about where kind of all that policy trickles down to.
Yeah, true. I mean, I think with the Independent Restaurant Coalition that was born out of mm-hmm. the pandemic, I think they are planning to be around for a while, and I think represent independent restaurants on all these issues. So hopefully, in PR, I mostly work with chef owner restaurants. So I see it, I see the struggle the rewarding factors as well. But there's so many independent restaurants. It's a big category that I think got in a sense overlooked, for a while. I think there's some attention to it now, which is good. We'll see what happens. I'm not planning every industry news segment for the rest of the rest of the show's history will be about this, but it has been, it just seems like there's constantly articles and conversations going on about it.
Yeah.
Okay. So for my solo dining experience this week, I'm going to give the rundown. I went to a place down in Miami and it's called Uchi. So here we go. The location, 252 Northwest 25th Street, Wynwood, Miami, Florida. The concept, a non-traditional take on Japanese food. It was founded in Austin, Texas in 2003. The chef and owner is Tyson Cole. He's a James Beard Award winner for Best Chef Southwest in 2011. So why'd I go? Well, I was down in Miami for my high school reunion, believe it or not. And I had one night that I decided to go out and check out this place. It was a newer place that opened, I think, about 6 months ago in Miami, which is my hometown. And I wanted to check it out. So my experience, well, I had a 5:30 early bird reservation. And I went in, I sat at the sushi bar. I'm walking around as people were wearing masks. I was distance from other people, so it felt safe. And the bonus or the plus of this early bird reservation, which I didn't realize until I was there, was they had a happy hour menu that included food from 5 to 6:30 with all these amazing dishes. So I was able to try a lot of different things. I ordered from this lovely sushi chef who was in front of me, and I had a really great time. So what did I get? Well, I had lots of little tasting size plates. I had the Hama chili, which they're known for, which is a yellow tail ponzu Thai chili and orange dish. That's the ingredients. I had yuca berry, which is salmon, Asian pear, kale, and blueberry. I had bincho nigiri with albacore tuna and kimchi, and I had avocado nigiri with uzu koshu and tamari. I had a walu walu, which is an oat grilled escalar, and I also got wagyu yakitori. So again, I got all these dishes, and it was, I'll tell you what I paid later. It was very reasonably priced. My take, it was all great. I'd say my favorites were the Hama chili and the bincho nigiri. Of course, it's the fish dishes. The ambiance, it's a large spaces, different areas from the sushi counter, the bar, the dining room. It's decorated in light blonde woods. It felt kind of casually elegant, if that's something. Perfect for solo dining at the sushi counter, and I'd say dinner with friends. There were other soloists there as well at the sushi counter. Interesting tidbit. So Uchi has outposts in Austin, Houston, Dallas, and Denver. It's part of the High Hospitality Group. It also includes Uchiko and Uchiba. And Uchi is translated from the Japanese word house, with its original location in a refurnished Austin, South Austin bungalow. Personal fun fact. So I was in Austin a couple years ago for the Hot Luck Festival. I look back, it was 2017. And I did go to their sister restaurant, Uchiko. I remember having a great solo meal there. And after this dinner, this was in Wynwood. So I walked around a little bit. There's Wynwood walls, this art galleries and art on the walls is basically what Wynwood Walls is. And lots of new restaurants and bars and shops. So it was really developed since I'd last been back a couple, maybe like a year ago. Or actually, I probably hadn't been there since the pandemic. So it was probably like 2 years ago. The cost of this meal, $41, not including tax gratuity. It was like sushi restaurant with all those dishes. I was like, that's a good value. Would I go back? Yes. Website uchimiami.com and Instagram is uchi_Miami. So there we go.
Ooh.
You guys been to Uchi or been to Miami?
I've been to Miami. I've been to the Wynwood area. Wynwood sometimes often reminds me of Philadelphia just because of all the art on the walls. And Philadelphia has so many murals all around, especially in the West Philadelphia Mantua area. So I always think of Philadelphia when I'm in Miami. But I've never been to Uchi. And it sounds fun and it sounds delicious.
It was delicious and fun. And I feel this is also a place that has a really large menu. Mm. There's a lot you could do straight sushi. I decided to do these composed dishes more just cause it felt like something special or different, about it, but, it was good. I would definitely recommend it. So
nice.
I've never been, but everything you just said just made me rethink the answer to that fire round and say whether out or dining in.
I hear you. I'm not going to hold you to your answer. Okay, so it's time for the final question. My next guest is Andrea Strong. She's the executive director of ROAR, which is a nonprofit founded in New York City in March 2020 by a group of industry professionals impassioned to fight for unemployed restaurant workers facing financial hardship and to advocate for an industry in crisis. And Andrea, I've known for a long time. She's considered to be like the first food blogger. She had a blog called The Strong Buzz, which when I just started doing PR back, I was starting in 2003, but I remember Andrea, The Strong Buzz, like you had to get your restaurant in her column. So she's now become the executive director of ROAR, which is really exciting. So Omar and Sibyl, what would you like to ask Andrea?
Well, I want to ask her, what's the biggest challenge of connecting the dots for the needs, you know, advocating for unemployed workers and connecting those dots for politicians who largely don't spend much time on the ground with folks like that, and especially in a community, in a restaurant community where for so many folks, English is not their first language, you know? And in a city like New York, what are the challenges there connecting those dots?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm also very curious about just ways that as business owners, we can prepare. Because I mean, it's unexpected if you have to lay someone off or someone, you know, you have to fire someone or whatever the situation is. But maybe what are some tips or tricks that we can kind of think about considering preparing for the for a more comfortable departure of our employees if they ever have to leave our business? You know, what are some ways to do that respectfully and just keeping in mind where we are as owners and companies and just where folks are as individuals?
Terrific. Great questions. I'm going to ask them both, see what Andrea has to say. And thank you guys so much. It's been really fun. I would keep chatting, but I need a longer show. But I wish you guys the best. I can't wait to get down to Philly and come to Honeysuckle Projects and see you guys in person. I'm glad we got to meet when you were in New York.
Yeah, thank you for having us. Can't wait to have you. We are planning on opening November 1st. That's the goal, fingers crossed. But when we do, we'll definitely send you the invitation.
Yes, yes. And we can go out afterwards and get cheesesteaks.
No, you know what? I mean, there's so many. We could. But I mean, the fact when you said from Barbacoa, I'd love to. I've been there once. I'd love to go back there. But there's so many great restaurants in Philly. We could go to one of Ellen's restaurants.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So visit a lot of our friends. We love Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Also, that's a favorite place of ours that we love sending people to and taking folks to. So it's
Nice. I was out there for the Philly Chef Conference one year, and they had a happy hour there at Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So I saw the space, but I didn't have like a full meal, but it was, I could see why you're recommending it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys so much. Wishing you much continued success, and I'll hope to see you soon.
Thank you.
My guests today have been chef founder Omar Tate and his wife business partner, Chef Sybil St. Aude Tate of Honeysuckle Projects, a multifaceted food company that focuses on the nuanced cultures and cuisines of the Black diaspora. Their website, honeysucklephl.com, that's for Philadelphia, and follow them at Coltrane215 at Sybil St. Aude at Honeysuckle_projects and at Honeysuckle_provisions. Follow me at Sherry Bayer at Bayer PR and at All Industry. My websites are BayerPublicRelations.com, SherryBayer.com, and AllInTheIndustry.com. And also my Facebook page is All in the Industry. And all of our shows are archived at HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We are also on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Thanks to my engineer today, Kevin. And thanks again to Omar and Sybil. I'm Sherry Bayer. I will be back next week with a new show. Hope you'll tune in then. And thank you for being part of All in the Industry. Bye. All in the Industry is powered by Simplecast. I'm Sherry Bayer, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, HRN is celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.